right, thank you. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you for being here today. So as we just heard, I will be, actually, I like this site better. I'll be talking today about this body of work I've had over the last year with my collaborator, Gifre Vidal, and more recently with a group led by Bartek Schick at Stanford. Okay. So much of this will be, I gave a talk here a few months ago as part of an entanglement workshop, so there'll be a lot of overlap, but hopefully we'll get to some of the more interesting and relevant stuff to high energy physics. Okay, so just begin with a sort of broad introduction of what I'm talking about today. So what I have here is three pictures. So these are just snapshot pictures of what a 2D classical icing model looks like at a set of different temperatures. So below criticality, you have some, almost all spins are ordered in one direction, corresponding to blue. Above criticality, I have this sort of almost random picture of spins. At criticality, I have something very interesting happening where I have these clusters of spins aligned in the same direction. I have clusters of all different length scales, so correlations at all different length scales. And so this is very interesting. It also makes the physics very difficult to manage in a lot of cases. So my goal is to try and, from some microscopic description, understand the emerging collective behavior of this many-body system. And again, it's very difficult because in order to understand this, I need to look at very large systems. So one sort of general strategy you can do is sampling, i.e. Monte Carlo, is I'm just going to generate a whole bunch of these with some proper important sampling and then build some statistics from that. Another sort of broad approach is based on the renormalization group or rescaling or coarse grading transformations I might use interchangeably depending on the context. And so here, the idea behind a rescaling or renormalization transformation is, so I start with the system, very, very many microscopic degrees of freedom, some interaction amongst them. What I want to do is to try and build an effective theory in terms of a few degrees of freedom that describes the initial system in some particular regime. So here I'm thinking about the low-energy, long-distance physics of this. Okay, so each of these transformations is somehow removing or integrating out, if I'm talking in the field theory language, some high-energy degrees of freedom that I don't need in this effective low-energy theory. Okay, so these ideas of renormalization are sort of very ubiquitous in field theories and incredibly useful in a number of ways, but often you're limited, I mean, by use of perturbation theory. So the key question of today's talk is, can we figure out how to do these things on the lattice in real space in a very general way, in a non-system specific way, not relying on perturbation theory? Okay, so just to give you an example of what this kind of real space RG could entail. So a very early idea was through Kadanoff's spin blocking, and Kadanoff actually sadly passed away earlier this week. So his idea was that, so I take my, say, lattice of classical spins, I'm going to do some very simple sort of blocking and coarse grading where I just take 3x3 blocks and replace the configuration with whatever has the majority vote, the dominant number. So I have 5 downspins, so I replace this with a downspin. Okay, and so by building on this very simple idea, you can go from some initial description to some, in terms of some renormalized parameters of these block spins, these block degrees of freedom. So this is sort of a very simple RG scheme. Unfortunately, it only really works in a in the context of the icing model or a few other cases. This rule of blocking is sort of very system specific. It's designed for this system. So how do we do this in a general way, non-perturbative, non-system specific? And what we would like out of this is we would like this RG to be consistent with RG for quantum fields and the continuum where we know about these things. So if I'm thinking about this as an RG transformation, I want the correct structure of RG fixed points that I would expect. If I'm, say, applying this to a discrete representation of a conformal field theory, then I want this to transform in an invariant way. I want to realize a discrete version of scale invariance. And also, if you want to use this as a numerical algorithm, which I'm not going to emphasize so much in this talk, but we also want it to be sort of computationally feasible. Okay, so just broadly speaking, our transformation will look something like this, where we start off with our system on a lattice. We somehow block together sites or degrees of freedom in some way, and then we truncate the block degrees of freedom down to something we want to keep. So the main considerations are, how do we do this blocking? Are we just literally taking local blocks in space and putting things together, or are we doing something more sophisticated? And also, how do we decide at this point what we want to truncate and what we want to keep in some very general way? So in the context of RG for quantum Hamiltonians on the lattice, a lot of this has already been understood very nicely. Okay, so imagine I have some Hamiltonian, I'm thinking on a 1D quantum lattice here, so maybe this is a Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet. So the question of how to truncate properly was answered very nicely by Steve White in the early 90s with the introduction of his DMRG algorithm. So here the idea was I should use the density matrix to decide what to keep and what to get rid of. And so this DMRG has become hugely popular, like the most popular, at least for 1D systems, numerical method. So very, very successful. And more recently, the considerations of how the structure of how I'm actually putting degrees of freedom together has been more seriously considered. So this was mainly people from the quantum information community thinking about entanglement. How do I design this RG transformation to be consistent with entanglement scaling? And so things that come out of this is this PEPS tensor network and this MERA tensor network, which I'm not actually going to be talking about today. But the point I want to make is by understanding how to do real space RG in the context of this quantum Hamiltonians on the lattice, we've got out a whole bunch of algorithms which are very powerful and very useful, and we've also improved our conceptual understanding of quantum states in a number of ways. In particular, the matrix product state, which relates to the DMRG algorithm, has been used to classify gapped phases. There's MERA, a lot of work is going into understanding, using this to better understand holographic dualities. So a lot of good stuff. So today I'm actually talking about something different, which is real space RG in the context of partition functions and path integrals of quantum systems. Okay, and what I'll show later on in the talk is that a very natural way to write a partition function is in terms of a lattice, a tensor network. Okay, so each of these is going to represent a tensor, and it's going to encode the Boltzmann weights of my configurations. And equivalent, and very similarly, I can represent the Euclidean path integral of a one-dimensional quantum system on the lattice as an equivalent tensor network, where now I've discretized imaginary time. So this is just discretized, just under the Trotter expansion of this path integral. Okay, so what's been done before in these approaches, I already showed you Kadanoff's spin blocking idea, but the next sort of really key development, I think, came with Michael Levin in this formulation of the tensor renormalization group. Okay, so this, going to explain these pictures later on, but it's some way of generating coarse grading transformations for these lattice systems. And it's since become a very active area of research. There have been very many generalizations and applications and all kinds of things. And the key thing they did here was they solved this, they figured out how to truncate the systems effectively, okay? In a very general way, in a way that can be applied to sort of give me a partition function, I can run this and get some good answers. What it didn't solve, however, was it has some flaw in the sense of if I'm trying to interpret this as generating an RG transformation, it doesn't give me everything I want. I don't get out the correct structure of fixed points. I don't get out scale invariance at the critical point. I don't even converge to anything at the critical point. And these are also, so these are conceptual problems, and they also, it also leads to computational problems in that the cost of, say, simulating a system near criticality becomes very high. It's very difficult to do. Okay, so recently, this was the idea of this new work with Vidal, was a way to do real space renormalization on the lattice that fix these problems, okay? So really getting scale invariance, proper fixed points, and also addressing these computational problems. So this is tensor network renormalization, which at least will be the early part of my talk. Okay, so that was my introduction. Before I actually talk about the methods, we're going to talk about the setup, which is how to actually get these tensor network representations of our systems. Okay, so the notation I'm going to be using is this diagrammatic notation where, so I have a tensor A. So a tensor with four indices is represented as a blob with four legs. So each leg is an index of the tensor. So this could just be a four-dimensional array of numbers. Okay, and whenever I have two tensors connected with a line, this just represents a summation over the index involved. Okay, so probably most people are familiar with this notation, or if not, it's very simple to pick up. And of course, we want to use it because doing tensor networks of more than a few tensors with this with a standard notation becomes pretty impossible, whereas it's rather nice if we just can draw the picture. Okay, so here I have a square tensor network with some periodic boundaries, so no open indices, so this whole thing will just contract to a number, a scalar. Yep. People clear with this? Okay, so how do I get to my representation of a system as a network? So let's just take a simple example. This icing model, spins are plus one or minus one. Okay, I have some Hamiltonian for this, which is basically saying spins want to align with each other. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the Boltzmann weights of the four edges around a plaquette. I'm going to encode them in a tensor. Okay, so this tensor, here is its definition. It's just defined to be the sum of the four Boltzmann weights for around the edge. Okay, so this will, if I fix these indices as one or two, which is up or down, then these will tell me my correct probabilities, unnormalized probabilities for the configurations. Okay, so now if I have a bunch of these tensors connected in this way, so I only need one tensor for every second plaquette because I only need to encode the edge once, then this directly equates to the partition function. So the scalar I get if I had this on periodic boundaries and contracted to a scalar is just the partition function, the norm of the probabilities. Okay, so this is just a very natural way of writing down a partition function as this network of tensors. And likewise, I'm not going to explain it here, but there's a very standard way of discretizing a path integral or trotterizing a path integral to get this network representation. So this is our starting point for all our methods. We just assume we have this representation. Sorry.
You write it as a trace of tensors in the square pattern. Mm-hmm. Now, a trace of certain properties. Does this network have certain, is the trace of a network like this of similar cyclic properties or things like that?
Sure, I mean, it depends.
Do you think simply?
It may depend on some particulars, but in general, yes, it does. Well, I could quite easily take this and draw it down here, and I'd have the same diagram.
If the A's are the same,
then that's the case. If I'm allowed to just drag indices over one another without inferring a sign, then that's the case. If it's fermions, I may have to take the sign into account.
If I give you four-index tensor. So when I have a matrix and I take a trace of a power, the way I would do that would be diagonal as a matrix. So is there anything analogous here if I give you those four end numbers? How do you calculate the trace from this lattice easily?
I mean, in some cases you can do a transfer matrix approach. Like if I gave you a long cylinder of these, I wouldn't have to do the calculation, all of these contractions. I could just diagonalize the transfer matrix in some cases and get information from that. It's one of the long things. So in particular, this is the goal at the moment is, we start off with one of these four-index tensors. We want to figure out the long-distance behavior. So, and you can't just look locally at the coefficients to figure this out. You need to put them in a big network and somehow evaluate that big network.
It's really good. I mean, if I square lattice A's, where A's, and the four numbers.
Well, if you could, you'd be this is an equivalent statement would be, if you give me a simple Hamiltonian with nearest neighbor interactions, it should be a simple way of getting the phase information from that. I mean, that's what we're trying to do, and it seems to be a very difficult problem. You can't just understand it by looking at the local. Well, it's very difficult.
If it was a two-index structure, then that would have been possible, right?
If you just have if it's just a one line of tensors, then you can do it very easily. This is like a one-dimensional classical system. You can, of course, evaluate it very easily. So that's the notation, and this is how we set up our problem. Okay, so how these previous approaches worked with this. Okay, so the goal is to try and, exactly as we had said before, start with this local array of numbers in this tensor and try and build up to the effective collective behavior through some sequence of sort of blocking transformations.
I have a question.
Yeah?
How is this different from the vertex model? Or is it model?
I'm talking about So this is a method for for coarse graining these models.
I'm trying to understand in what sense the tensor network is different from a vertex model.
Could be the same thing. Well, in a vertex model, you're talking about something very specific, where here, tensor network can mean a ton of things. Okay, so how do we do this? Coarse graining. So this is the answer given by Michael Levin almost 10 years ago. So here it's a method based upon blocking and truncation. So I'll just give you an example of what the truncation involves. So here I have just a 2D classical Ising model. I'm just blocking a bunch of these tensors to begin with. And now I want to try and truncate this tensor in a way that keeps the important information, discards the degrees of freedom that aren't important. Okay. And so what he proposed to do is that I consider this as a matrix between across this partition. So this would be a 256 by 256 matrix where these two legs are, I take the product. Okay, now I'm doing the singular value decomposition. So I'm decomposing this as a product of two unitary matrices and a bunch of singular weights. And so when I look at the singular weights, they decay pretty quickly. So these singular weights are what you use to identify degrees of freedom. I should keep the large singular weights. I can get rid of the small singular weights. Okay, so the singular value decomposition can be performed on any tensor. So this is a very general way of deciding how to truncate a many-body system. Okay, and in a lot of cases, it's pretty accurate. And so that's what my truncated SVD looks like. And this tensor renormalization group works by applying alternating patterns of this truncated SVD, so between sort of top left and bottom right, or left bottom and top right. OK, Okay, so I apply this alternating pattern of truncated SVDs. So each time I'm pulling apart a four-index tensor and the product of three-index tensors, discarding some degrees of freedom, and then I'm contracting them in some, different way. And what I wind up with, so four of these three-index tensors go into a new four-index tensor, and what I've done is I've reduced the number of tensors in my network by half in this transformation. Is that clear? And so the idea is by building this up, I can eventually get to this long-range effective behavior, and I can compute things, and in general, everything actually works pretty well. Okay. So that's TRG. An equivalent way of doing this, rather than using a truncated SVD, so this equivalent way will be useful for later on in terms of thinking about these things, is rather than doing a matrix decomposition, I can think about applying a projector onto my tensor. So this projector is the product here of a two isometric tensors in this way, and I'm applying it, I'm choosing this W such that it acts as an approximate resolution of the identity when applied to my A. So it's actually just an equivalent way of doing the same thing, is I could do an SVD, or I could apply a projector to my tensor, a properly chosen projector. Okay, so whether I can think about doing this tensor coarse grading in this way, where I start with my network, I put in some projectors. So this is an approximate step where I've put in projectors that are optimized to be close to the identity, and then I've done some tensor contractions. Okay, and this is equivalent to doing what I showed you before with this truncated SVD. Okay, so it's just slightly different ways of doing the same sort of coarse graining transformation here.
And at this point, have you set things up so that the bond dimension after the normalization group step is the same as it was before the normalization group step, or is that something that's floating?
That's an important consideration. In practice, we shouldn't be choosing this. We should be keeping as many degrees of freedom as we need to keep.
Right. But if you find that it increases, it doesn't.
And this is actually the important part, is what I want to show you now, is this is the spectrum of these tensors as I'm doing the coarse grading transformation. Okay, so I start off my initial tensor, I coarse grain, coarse grain, coarse grain. When I look, I see the spectrum is becoming denser at each step. So this is just the spectrum of singular values. So I've just done this, just doing this cut up here. As a function of RG step. So I'm just using this as a way of saying that the amount of information in these tensors is getting more at each step. I have to increase the dimension of these tensors at each step if I want to keep an accurate coarse grading transformation. So this is from a conceptual level, this is not good either. This is a critical Ising model, and I'm clearly not converging to anything. It's clearly diverging. The entropy of this spectrum increases by linearly at each step, and it's a computational problem. Okay, and let's actually now look at, so what I'm plotting here is I've taken these tensors and I've just reshaped them into a matrix, and then I'm just plotting the elements of these matrices in this color plot. So white corresponds to big elements. So this is actually just a picture of the tensor itself. So here I'm coarse graining above criticality, and you can see I do a few steps and I get to an invariant tensor. Okay, so the tensor coarse grains into itself. I take a different temperature, a higher temperature, and again I get to a fixed point. The trouble is these are different fixed points. They're not the same tensor, and they're not related to each other by any transformation. They have a different spectrum. Okay, so what we want this is the 2D classical Ising model. We want to reproduce this very simple phase diagram, an ordered phase, a disordered phase, a critical point between them. When we apply this previous class of coarse graining method, what we get is something that looks very different. We get different fixed points depending on which temperature we start at on either side, and we don't get any convergence when we apply to criticality. Okay, so this is what I would say is the conceptual problems with this previous coarse graining. Okay, so can we understand why this is the case, and how do we fix it, is the next question. Okay. So, and a very hand-wavy way of actually understanding why this is not working so well, is we can sort of look at this basic blocking step and can think about what's happening. So in my formulation, each of these indices was a spin and these tensors were the Boltzmann weights. And when I apply these isometries, what I'm actually doing is, so these, the correlations between these spins are somehow being absorbed into the isometries and they can be safely removed as part of the coarse graining step. But what you notice is across the edges of my 4x4 block, these are also correlated, but these are not removed. These propagate to the next length scale. Okay, and no matter how I set up my blocking, like if I blocked the side degrees of freedom together, then I would miss the corner correlation. So just putting degrees of freedom together with isometries is never going to give you the proper removal of short-range detail. A more concrete example, so we can cook up this toy model where we can set of tensors that just have these correlations around the edges, okay? So I'm thinking each index is now a double index that decomposes the product of these two finer ones, and I'm just correlating around the edges. So these are called corner double line tensors. And so I can build, say, a network of these tensors, and it just represents some partition function where I just have these very simple correlations that only happen around plaquettes. Okay. And when I apply one iteration of this tensor renormalization group to this network, so I apply the isometries, I can track everything in, I see that these side correlations still remain. So the corner ones are gone, but the point is I've gone from so this network of corner double line tensors to a new network of corner double line tensors. Okay, so short range correlated state propagates to a short range correlated state. It shouldn't do that. It should go to a trivial state because this one only had short range correlations. So this is sort of the main idea where we start is how do we design an RG transformation that can get rid of everything and not just some of it, not just some of the short range detail. And in particular, it's this failure to remove these short range correlations that's causing this increase in entropy, this computational breakdown that we had before. Okay. So this motivated this new approach with Giffre. And the starting point for this, she came from, so this idea of failing to remove all the degrees of freedom is actually very much related to earlier work done by Giffre and actually myself during my PhD in the context of these tensor network ansatz on the lattice. Okay, so here, this mirror, this multi-scale entanglement renormalization ansatz, the key change from the previous network was some addition of these disentanglers, they're called unitary tensors, that properly captured all of the short-range correlations. So what we wanted was, can we have similar ideas to fix this coarse graining of path integrals? Okay, so this is what we had before with this tensor renormalization group. What we're proposing now maybe looks very obvious, but it certainly wasn't at the time. Was before we do our coarse graining, we're going to put these pairs of U and U dagger into the partition function. Okay, so this is an exact step. All I've done is just put in some unitaries that is a resolution of the identity. But now when I do my second step of putting in my isometries, so my approximate step, it now looks very different. So this is my basic coarse graining step. So disentanglers, then these isometries, and then I do my contractions to get some new tensors. But what we can see is that the problem previously of only getting rid of some of the short-range correlations and propagating others is that when we have these additional tensors, so these unitaries that act on the side, these disentanglers, can actually get rid of the short-range correlation that would otherwise be there. So in this simple case of these this toy model with just these short-range correlations, we can show analytically that yes, we can get rid of everything. We can show the proper choice of these tensors to actually take this to a product state. So in this very simple toy model case, everything works out well. And actually, in practice, we do it slightly differently. It turns out we only need half as many of these tensors to get rid of everything we need to get rid of. And so this is what the full RG step that takes a square lattice to a square lattice looks like. This is just more technical detail, actually. And actually, of course, we need to choose the tensors that properly coarse grain the system. So we have some numerical algorithms that do this. They work very well. I have a long paper that explains this in a lot of.
That procedure depends on the A's.
It depends on the A's. So you want to choose some tensors such that the error in going from one to the other is minimized. So each of these transformations is an exact or a quasi-exact transformation, and the details of what you choose depends on the A tensors.
So you have to choose a different U at each step?
If I'm doing a critical system, if I manage to map some collection of A's to an equivalent collection of A's, then I can reuse the same tensors. So this is, if I capture scale invariance, then I can reuse the same tensors. If I don't have a scale invariance system, then the behavior depends on the scale, so the tensors depend on the scale. Actually, do we have a clock around here?
So by optimizer, that's your third measure. You don't get rid of all completely.
What's that? We do in this in the very simple case where we just had some simple toy model. But the other case we actually still do well up to some numerical accuracy. So we can look at that right now, actually, how well do we do, say, applied to a critical system or applied to some much more interesting system. Okay, so again, the 2D classical Ising model, we want to reproduce this very simple phase diagram. So this is what we had previously with this Levin tensor renormalization group. Okay, so we had two different fixed points, and the way you can interpret this is they still contain some microscopic baggage that we've failed to remove from the system. So when we apply the new approach, we go to the same fixed point, and in this case it's a trivial fixed point. So two temperatures above criticality, we go to this very simple fixed point tensor, which just has one non-zero element, so it just represents a product state. So we have succeeded in getting rid of all of the short range correlation and getting to this simple product state where it should be. Okay, so looking at the three different, so below criticality, above criticality, and at criticality. So below critical, we get a different simple fixed point. So here we have two non-zero elements. The partition function made from these tensors just represents the all up plus the all down state with equal weight. So this is what we expect in the ordered phase. At the critical point, we get this very interesting emergent scale invariant behavior. The tensor looks the same at all scales. And I think this picture sort of very nicely encapsulates the problem, is that if we just look locally at these tensors, they look very similar. By construction they are very similar because they're the same Boltzmann weights, just at slightly different temperatures. But we've succeeded in seeing, oh no, they actually do belong to different phases by this RG method. And if you don't believe me, here's a slightly more difficult one. So here we start just above criticality, and it looks like it's a scale invariant system. It looks like it's scale invariant, and eventually we get to our trivial fixed point. We see, oh, it is actually above criticality, it's not scale invariant.
You're plotting the 16 by 16.
Yes. So this is just keeping one dimension 4 on my tensors.
Very simple things which correspond to the same. At criticality, you have some kind of structure there. Mm-hmm. Can you look at that tensor and see something?
Yes, we can do a lot of interesting stuff. Actually, so so you can look at this tensor. Actually, what is more interesting to look at is not the tensor, but the RG transformation that maps between the scale invariant tensors. And this actually contains all of the information of the CFT, the critical fixed point. We can extract that from this fixed point RG map. Okay. I'll just run very quickly. So numerical results. So here I just plot spontaneous magnetization and specific heat as a function of temperature. This is just to show you we have a numeric algorithm based upon these ideas. We compute numbers. The numbers look good. Even close to a critical system, even close to criticality, we get good numbers. And a lot of this is we can do large systems very accurately. So this all works. It looks good. When we actually look at, so this is a comparison of the truncation error as a function of RG step for our method versus the old one. The old one truncation error increases very quickly. You get a smaller truncation error by using a larger bond dimension by keeping more degrees of freedom, but it always shoots up, at least the criticality. Here, we don't have an increase in truncation error. We can do large system size as well while keeping high accuracy. In terms of, say, the free energy, the previous method converges very slowly to the exact free energy. We converge exponentially faster to the exact free energy. So just as a numerical algorithm, we're doing a lot better than the previous one. But that's not the emphasis of my talk today. Okay.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
But each step would take a longer time, right?
Hmm?
The previous algorithm. Because you need to find, if you're not in criticality, you need to find U and W at every
yeah,
step.
Yeah, so we have a constant, so we have a constant overhead and cost, so it's maybe 100 times more expensive. But the point, it's overall, if you're comparing how much time you need to reach a certain accuracy, this is much better. So we have a constant overhead and cost, but an exponential increase in accuracy. So I'm not going to talk too much about that today. Okay. So hopefully at this point I've convinced you. Well, for starters, if you want to do these coarse grating transformations on the lattice, things are not quite so simple. You need to take account of a lot of details. But if you do it correctly, you can at least, like, hopefully I've convinced you that this tensor network renormalization does this in a way consistent with the RG we expect. We get proper fixed points, we get scale invariance, non-perturbative, non-system specific, and we also have a lot of computational advantages that come with it.
Excuse me, can you summarize for me what it is that led you to the correct choice? What led you to get the most efficient mechanism? Of course, you know the answer, but the question is, what is the criterion that you've used? I mean, for this, how did you? I still do not quite understand.
So the criteria we were basing it about is thinking about, we want to have a coarse grating transformation that can get rid of all of the short range detail. And sorry, what was your question?
Yeah, then how do you implement it?
Oh, and then there are many, many different schemes you can do compatible with this idea. The one I showed you today was somehow the simplest one I could think of. In practice, we may use a more complicated.
You just showed your best product.
There are very, very many schemes you can do to try and do this. This is just one example. Okay. So now I will use my remaining time to sort of talk about some more interesting stuff.
So what's the relationship between this and the 2D mirror?
There. Giving it away in the title. Okay, so hopefully what I've shown you now is that we can do these global rescalings of the lattice system in a way that's consistent with, say, the global rescalings we do in CFT or in other systems. But what we also know is that conformal field theories, they're not just invariant under global changes of scale, they're invariant under local changes of scale as well. So can we replicate these local changes of scale in a consistent way on this tensor network? So some of the things we want to do, for instance, is let's say take the punctured plane and do this logarithmic transformation where you map it to a cylinder. Okay, so I'm thinking about this as a sheet of rubber and I'm stretching it out, so the puncture is at one end of the cylinder and the infinite boundary is at the other end of the cylinder. And then there are also these other sort of more complicated local scale transformations of the sheet or of this inserted sheeted Riemann surface. And these are types of things we want to do to actually evaluate the critical data of a CFT. We want to be able to do these types of things on the lattice. Okay, so this is just my picture of what the logarithmic transformation in the CFT looks like. So I switch to a radial and an angular coordinate in my CFT, and I rescale the radial coordinate to make my metric flat again. Okay, so now I start with the 2D lattice of tensors where I've made a hole by taking some out. How do I do this coarse grading that takes me to the cylinder? So conceptually, what I'm doing is I want to coarse grain more when I'm away from the puncture. So I want to try and coarse grain in such a way that all of these balls are mapped to ones of equivalent size and sort of wrap it up on the cylinder. This looks like it would turn out to be very messy and very horrible. Actually, it comes out very nicely. So I'll just show you the pictures, relegating all of the details to this paper. But when I apply this when I apply my coarse grading algorithm to this network with a hole in it, so away from the hole, everything works as normal. I just get the same tensors I would have got in the bulk. When I'm near this puncture, so I have to leave these indices untouched. So I have some, it turns out I have some tensors here that map my initial degrees of freedom, my fine grade degrees of freedom at this puncture to my coarser grain degrees of freedom at the bulk. So these just, it just comes out like this. Okay, again, and now I can do the same transformation thinking about everything around this outside line as being the puncture and doing it the same as on the rest of the lattice. So I get this structure that looks like this, which is just my cylindrical network. Okay, so again, this is all of the details are in this paper, but we can do this transformation of this network, this local scale transformation, very nicely. The reason we want to do this is that this is the transfer operator that generates changes of scale for local operators in my CFT. If I have scale invariance in the bulk of my CFT, then it becomes translation invariance along the cylinder. Clear? Okay, so if I've done this correctly, if this is equivalent to the mapping of the CFT, I should expect the eigen operators of this to be the scale operators of my theory. So I do this transformation, and then I diagonalize this transfer operator. So here are the results for the 2D classical Ising model, and I get out very many of the scaling dimensions of this theory, actually with a relatively cheap calculation. So these are the dimensions of the operators that coarse grain into themselves. Okay, so this is clearly.
This description is the same as Vera for the visualization operator. The description you're using is constructed eigenstates in the visualization operator.
We've got to the. So in both ways, we're constructing a transfer operator that transforms local operators in scale. Here, we've got to it very differently, and it's kind of a different operator.
Put that from the point of view of the variation of the state.
We can say some more concrete things in a second. There's actually a very nice relation. So what I'd say here is that this transformation we've done is clearly sort of doing what it should do in comparison to these continuum things. What about the plane with two punctures? Again, you would expect this is a very complicated transformation that maps the plane with two punctures to the pair of pants. Again, you might think it comes out very messy, but we can do this, and I'm just drawing the pictures. So my two punctures transform as a single puncture until they fuse, and then they transform as a single puncture again. So we can construct this network, and then what we can do is we can close each end of the two legs and the waist of the pants with a scaling operator. And the reason we do this is this allows us to work out the fusion coefficients of the theory by doing this. So we do this funny mapping of the plane of tensors, we put the scaling operators on the different ends, and we get the fusion coefficients out very nicely. Okay, so we really are doing this local scale transformation of the network in a consistent way. Okay, so here is what we've had all the questions about. So what I explained today was a coarse graining transformation for the path integral based on some ideas of disentangling. And I said it's very analogous to this tensor network ansatz for ground states of quantum systems. So how we sort of fix the coarse graining of the path integral is very analogous to these ground state ansatz. It turns out there's actually a much nicer relation between these two things we can formulate, as we did in this paper. So I'm actually hoping someone will tell me when I'm running out of time, otherwise I might.
Maybe 15 minutes left.
Oh, there's tons of time. Good, good, good. Okay, and so the way we see this, so what I'm going to start off with is I'm going to start off with the path integral on a finite cylinder, okay? So the cylinder I'm thinking about is finite in width, which is my spatial degree of freedom, but extends up infinitely high. So what this represents, the ground state of a one-dimensional quantum system on some lattice down here. Okay. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to apply my coarse grading algorithm to this. So everywhere away from the boundary, things just block coarse transform as normal. When I'm close to the boundary, if you look at the details, which I'm not going to show you here, I get some remnant tensors that map my fine degrees of freedom on the boundary, which I'm not allowed to touch, to my coarser degrees of freedom in the bulk. And when I do this several times, so I do this and eventually I get a finite width cylinder, a very small width cylinder that I can diagonalize exactly. And so following this construction, what we can do is we're turning this path integral representation into a mirror through a sequence of sort of quasi-exact steps. Okay, and mirror looks much nicer if you draw it as a tiling of the hyperbolic disk. There we go. Okay, so another way you can understand what we've been doing is we're starting with this path integral and we're kind of coarse graining in an inhomogeneous way. We're doing this local scale transformation to coarse grain tensors more that are further away from the boundary. So if we shrunk all of these circles down to an equivalent size, or coarse grain them down to an equivalent size, this is how we wind up with our representation on the hyperbolic disk. Okay, so previously, this mirror, this was a proposal, it was an ansatz, like we think ground states should be represented this way due to some reasoning with entanglement. So what we've seen with this tensor network renormalization is that mirror is actually something that emerges, it's more fundamental. It emerges from something more fundamental, that this mirror, if I try and coarse grain this path integral as much as I can, what I get out from that is a mirror. Okay, so this is computationally a very different way of getting a mirror than we're used to. It's also sort of has some nice conceptual ramifications as well. Okay, and just to be, if this bulk theory coarse grains is scale invariant under coarse graining, then of course this mirror just will become scale invariant as well. Okay, so scale invariance and coarse graining the bulk, what we saw becomes scale invariance in this ansatz. And likewise, we can do similar things. So if we take now a finite strip of this path integral, so now we've got two open boundaries. So this e to the minus beta h can represent a thermal state of my Hamiltonian, or we could alternatively represent a thermofield double, depending on what beta I choose. When we coarse grain this, we get a mirror representation for a thermal state, which again, you can read more about in this work. And so just very recently, so yesterday, a new paper came out. So this was the work of, collaborated with Bartek Shek and other postdocs at Stanford. And I'll just advertise this very quickly on one slide. He'll be here in a few weeks if you want to talk to him. Okay, so the idea here is, let's start with the vacuum of a CFT represented as a mirror. We're going to do the quotient of a state. So, and taking the quotient involves, in this case, actually removing tensors from the network and reconnecting the edges in a certain way. So the quotient in this case is, so this is a representation of the ground state. Now we're getting rid of some of the tensors and reconnecting this. And in the CFT, it's just equivalent to some particular scale transformation or.
So in the field theory, are you, you're making an identification under some scaling symmetry? What is the continuum statement?
Yeah, you're making some identification.
Of the states or in
the two-dimensional Euclidean surface, you're doing the path interval. You've got a two-dimensional path interval, so one plus one. And you're making, you're changing the path interval over a certain manifold, the path interval over a quotient. That's the
quotient.
Some element of the conformal group. The same one you would use to make the thermal field double out of the vacuum, or the BQZ black hole.
Yeah. Against it. And this is the whole idea. It's the same. So by doing the same one that you'd make the thermofield double out of the vacuum, let's do this on the mirror and see what happens. If the mirror is representing a CFT, then it should be the case that this structure you get by doing the quotient is equivalent to a thermal state. And in this paper, we actually do this calculation and see, yes, this actually works out very well, and you get very accurate with the exact temperature you expect it at. So this is, again, just more evidence that this structure is doing the proper local scale transformations, or realizing the local scale transformations of the CFT in a consistent way.
Are those randoms really just identifications? They look like a normal matchup.
You have to match them up in some clever way. So the matchup is, you have,
are you, like there are more dots along the top boundary than along the bottom boundary?
Which is, yes, so the matching up becomes more skewed as you go down. You can do it in a consistent way.
Okay, there's something, it's not just matching point for point, there's something more subtle going on.
You're matching point for point, but it's spreading out.
What do you do with the intervening points?
You do all of the points, but you see, you have more on the bottom than the top, but it becomes progressively skewed to the side because of that fact. So you're still doing a one-to-one identification between all of the points on either side.
I see. I think I just missed some dots.
So this is what I hopefully convinced you of today, is that we can do scale transformations for theories on the lattice in a way that's consistent with the continuum. And again, we're hoping that this is, so this is helping with sort of conceptual understanding of many-body physics. It's also leading to sort of new algorithms for simulation of many-body physics. Thanks for your attention. Only in very limited cases.
You try various things until.
In all but a very few select cases, this U will have to be determined numerically. In some cases, we can do it. In some very specific cases, we can do it exactly. In some other cases, we may have some little bit of structure, but usually it's a numerical thing.
But you must be minimizing something.
Yeah. Sure. We're not just throwing random U's at the problem. That would take a long time. Yeah, it was way back here. This. So the U that came. But if we go back too far, I probably do. The U that came with it. So you have some equation like this that you're trying to minimize.
What's the most complicated case you can know it and what it means?
Well, usually it's been like gapped fixed points, certain topological systems, toric code type stuff. I have some ideas about actually finding these for simple CFTs now, but this is not finished work yet. So say for the icing model, the quantum XX model, I can tell you what you should put here.
So do you expect to be able to apply the methods of sort of differential rescaling for an arbitrary conformal transformation, or was there something special about the ones that managed to get to
work? Well, not arbitrary conformal, like here we're restricted to like a single time slice and doing as we discussed today with like real only certain types, let's say.
Certain types like
essentially any that just involves some local rescaling in space of my path integral, I could do.
In two dimensions, then you are just thinking about local rescaling, which would be an arbitrary function. Mm-hmm. You could do that.
Yes, they are. If you want to, you can easily do many more complicated examples than these ones I showed you.
If not, let some of us be going.